Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Making Sense with Steve Lazor.
Y'all ready for this?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, fellow liberals and Democrats, inquisitive Republicans, and concerned citizens of all backgrounds. Welcome to Making Sense with Steve Lazor, the show that breaks down the top issues in the last week in politics, strips out all the nonsense, and provides you the best analysis in political media. Welcome aboard, and let's get to work. Today we will air the second of two special programs while I'm abroad. Next week we'll return to our regular format, but today we have a full show of my interview with Jack Clunin, the FBI special agent in charge of the New York FBI's efforts against Al-Qaeda and bin Laden from 1996 to 2002. The true behind-the-scenes stories about this episode is that this discussion with Agent Clunin that I taped back in September was supposed to be a 15 to 20 minute interview. And I was concerned before it started that it wouldn't be interesting or exciting enough to air. The interview started, and 45 riveting minutes later, and I realized that I had totally gone beyond the amount of time available for the show, and that at some point I realized that I would want to air the entire thing, because it really is that good. It's an amazing story of infiltration, interrogation, and cloak-and-dagger spying. I had no idea that these kinds of things were going on in both directions in the fight with Al-Qaeda. The kinds of things that Al-Qaeda operatives were doing right here in the United States will shock you. We're going to go to commercial, and then when we come back, we're going to air the entire interview uninterrupted. So sit back and enjoy, and we'll get started right after this.
Do you know our sense of smell is the most important after our sense of sight? It's the most powerful as well, and it triggers memories and emotions, and is the most compelling aspect to make you feel wonderful. At scentaprises.com, that's scenterprises.com, we take you on a fragrance journey to learn about the magic and mystery of scent to create your very own custom perfume. We have an exquisite range of perfume blends which spans the entire fragrance palette, from sparkling citrus notes to light, fresh, and clean herbals and marine notes, florals that everyone will love, such as fresh, gentle, sexy, and heady florientals. And if you prefer sophisticated fragrances, our blends of spicy, amber, woodsy, musky, mossy, and luscious gourmand vanilla notes are warm, sensual, and combine beautifully with all the blends. So why wear what everyone else wears when you can create your very own custom perfume? Be different. Contact Sue at scentaprises.com. Scentaprises, our business makes you sensational.
What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, B-A-D-L-E-R.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R.
Zero Juliet uploaded.
Hi,
I'd like to welcome former FBI Special Agent Jack Clunan to the show. From 1996 to 2002, Clunan was the senior case agent assigned to the Bin Laden Squad in the New York office of the FBI. The Bin Laden Squad, if you've never heard the term, they were charged with the responsibility of building a prosecutable case against Osama bin Laden and against other folks like Ayman al-Zawahiri and other high-ranking members of al-Qaeda. And in that role, Clunan traveled globally, finding members of al-Qaeda, gaining their cooperation to assist in the prosecution of those who carried out the deadly attacks on the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Kenya and Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And as a result of these activities, Clunan gained some real insight into how al-Qaeda worked from those al-Qaeda insiders who agreed to cooperate with the U.S. voluntarily. Clunan is a consultant on terrorism for ABC News, and although the term is a bit overused these days, he and his team were some of the real heroes in the fight against al-Qaeda. So welcome to the show, Mr. Clunan.
Thank you very much, Steve. Nice to be here.
Let me jump right in. How did you come to be involved with the efforts against al-Qaeda?
Well, in late December 1995, early 1996, the then director of Central Intelligence signed what they called a presidential finding. It was an intelligence finding that was presented to the then President Clinton, which outlined rather broadly that this group called al-Qaeda and its leader, Osama bin Laden, posed a threat to U.S. national security. It's a much broader finding, but that's kind of the gist of it. And as a consequence, it came that there was a sort of a three-prong approach where the CIA was certainly working it, the NSA was certainly doing what it does, and the Justice Department was asked or tasked to build a prosecutable case against bin Laden, as you mentioned in your introduction. And as a consequence, the Southern District of New York, the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, and the New York Office of the FBI was tasked with that objective. And that's how it all evolved.
And that was back in 1996, right?
1996, it began in earnest, yes.
Okay, and then almost right away, in 1996, a man by the name of Jamal al-Fadl literally falls into your lap. What did he mean to your team?
Well, I sort of chuckle a little bit when we talk about Jamal and that he fell into our laps, because it would, you know, Jamal was in some respects shopping himself around. He had touched base with the Saudis and some other intelligence services, who I think were a bit suspect of him. But when he walked into the U.S. Embassy in Eritrea, he was initially debriefed by the regional security officer from State Department and a representative from the CIA. Because of that presidential finding that I alluded to earlier, we were made aware of it, and a brilliant attorney named Pat Fitzgerald from the Southern District of New York and one of my colleagues, Dan Coleman, were dispatched to debrief Jamal, which they did in country, in Eritrea, and then they moved him voluntarily, if you will, to Germany, and they debriefed him over probably a 10-day period, as I recall, and that was a real eye-opener. At that point in 1996, early on, we were still struggling to figure out what it was that al-Qaeda was all about. We had sort of a rudimentary idea, but then having Jamal come in and talk to us, it opened up the whole idea of what al-Qaeda was. It gave an insight into its structure. It started to identify individuals who were playing roles, and that this wasn't just an organization of like-minded people who were doing charitable work. We found out a lot about what their intents were, how they operated, what the level of potential threat it was to the United States, and it really kick-started the investigation dramatically.
And what was the impression that you got overall? Was al-Qaeda, right at that moment, I mean, there were obviously the president doesn't issue findings and put together whole teams for something that's not a threat, but from the very beginning, did you have a sense that these guys were a real deal that needed to be kept in check and worried about by a good deal of folks? Or
even in the very early stages, we came to the conclusion that they did pose a threat. Did we understand at that point in time that the threat was global and that the United States was a described by al-Qaeda as one of its principal enemies? The answer is yes. What we didn't know was what sort of operational expertise that they had, what sort of funding was available, and how that manifested itself, who some of the key players were, even to the point where we understood largely through Jamal initially, who was closest to bin Laden, who was some of the key decision makers, and it was demystified. And as a consequence, many of us found out, or many of us concluded, I should say, that it was far more organized than we had imagined. Yes, it was a diffuse network of people, and that was to some extent the genius of what al-Qaeda was, because in Arabic it's described as the base. And so we learned what it was like to become a mujahideen, or a jihadist, and what brought people into Afghanistan and the Sudan, how they were trained, and how they were sent back to their own countries to do as they will. And so, again, we had an idea based largely on Jamal's debriefings, what a day in the life of Osama bin Laden was like, how the operation functioned from top to bottom, because it was a very organized structure, how religious orders, for example, that might authorize an attack were debated and issued, who was the military commander within al-Qaeda at the time, how this military commander would look at potential targets. They were not frivolous with their resources. They didn't spend time on fanciful objectives that had no probability of success. And I think all of us who were involved at that point in time took a step back and said to ourselves, it's much more organized than we had thought. And when you have organization and you have some level of financing and you've decided that the United States is your principal enemy and needs to be punished, you knew that you were in for a handful.
You're getting all this information from this guy. Now, how do you know that he's not feeding you disinformation? How did you verify that he was who he was and that his information was good?
You know, that's a very, very good question. And I will tell you that Pat Fitzgerald, who was the lead prosecutor at the time, and a fellow, an attorney by the name of, I can't remember his last name, I can't remember right now, we were always very suspect at first. You know, I think that expression that Ronald Reagan used, you know, trust but verify.
Mm-hmm.
So we needed to be able to corroborate a lot of what was said. You know, what was Jamal's motivation for cooperating with the United States? You know, what dirty laundry did he have? You know, and the way it was handled, I thought, was really quite brilliantly. He was treated as a cooperating witness. In other words, all the rights and privileges that attach to a cooperating witness in our legal system, you know, stuck to Jamal. There was no, lack of a better term, you know, threats against him. We treated him humanely. He was given legal counsel. And as it worked out, the longer he was exposed to our system of justice and how the FBI and prosecutors work, the more comfortable he was. We weren't doing anything that we wouldn't do to any other subject or, frankly, that went on in any precinct station in New York City or with any trained, you know, interrogator or a good detective. We knew what the objective was, and through the course of time, as he got more and more confident with us, we got more and more confident with him, we just didn't, you know, everything that he said to us needed to be verified to the extent that we could. And, of course, one of the critical elements that you have in this is that when he starts to incriminate himself in activity, you know that you've sort of crossed a very important bridge. He knew, you know, at some point, and rather early on in our relationship, that there were no promises. He wasn't given, you know, the idea that, you know, he was going to be given a large amount of money to induce him to cooperate.
Oh, interesting. No money, no immunity or anything like that.
No, he knew that he was going to have to go into court, and I think the term is called allocute, and he was going to have to, plead before a judge as to what he did. Now, the judge obviously is in charge of sentencing and has sentencing guidelines. But it was all done very transparently. It was his cooperation with the United States extended for a period of years, and he had a tremendous capacity. His memory was quite good. He had a tremendous capacity for recognizing photographs, and he would be able to tell you, for example, what somebody's particular code name was. He would be able to tell you, I think you should look for this guy. I think this guy is vulnerable and might be available for an approach if you could find him. I knew this guy. This is what his name was. This is what his job was. This is where I saw him, and this is what he did. So it was, if I could draw the analogy, it would be very similar to a soldier in a organized crime gang turning on the organization and providing you with an insight that you couldn't get otherwise. At that point in time, in 1996, you know, technology was still very good, but the prospect of, you know, the FBI being able to put a very, you know, good source within the Al-Qaeda organization was nearly impossible. One of the things that I think your listeners should realize is that even in those early stages in 1996, because Al-Qaeda was created as an organization in 1989, Al-Qaeda operated under a theory. They knew that the likes of the Saudis, the Jordanians, and others would very easily be able to put a mujahid or a mujahideen into some of the training camps in Afghanistan. Some of the training camps that were sort of rudimentary, people would come in and get some indoctrination and a little bit of training. Again, the genius of what Al-Qaeda was at that time is that they were able to vet some of the mujahideen. They were able to identify those people who really had the spirit, the intelligence, the drive, the commitment to go to the next level. And so, you know, again, not a fly-by-night organization. They weren't going to waste their human capital or their financial capital.
So Jamal, you know, if I could use the term, was an intelligence goldmine. And you interrogated him for years, got good information from him. But I don't want to completely concentrate on him. You also got good information from a number of other Al-Qaeda operatives, like a guy by the name of Ali Abdul Saud Mohammed. Can you tell us about him and as much as you can about the information you got from him?
Well, Ali was certainly a unique character, very intelligent, a former colonel in the Egyptian Special Forces, who was mustered out of the Egyptian army in part because of his Islamic leanings, and there was some idea that he might have been connected in some way, somehow, to the assassination of Anwar Sadat. Right. Never proven. But way back when, Ali became a protege of Zawahiri, bin Laden's number two man, when Ayman Zawahiri, Dr. Ayman Zawahiri, was basically the head of the Egyptian Islamic Jihad, which eventually folds into Al-Qaeda. And during that time, Zawahiri had tasked Ali to do various things. For example, we might want to hijack and blow up an Egyptian airliner. Can you please do research on how we could breach the security at an airport, how we might want to be able to take over that plane? Would it be best to be a suicide mission? That sort of thing. And then his taskings became even more important and, I suppose, aggressive, because ultimately he was directed to come to the United States and see if he could not get into the U.S. intelligence community, broadly speaking, in some shape or form. So he joined after having, he worked as, I suppose, an agent he did work as an agent for the CIA for a period of time for one operation, and they got rid of him because they didn't trust him, and he had basically given up the fact that he had worked for the agency, and he told the people that he was targeted against. He filed an application to join the FBI as a translator, and having failed in those two endeavors, he joins the U.S. Army, having been a colonel in the Egyptian Special Forces. And he was such a good, I suppose, recruit And given his past experience, he was sent to the John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School after basic training.
Now, is this before or after his dealings with Zawahiri and those folks?
This is all during. He's in contact with these people.
Wow.
And so you can see how far back Zawahiri's ambitions go.
So at what point does he become involved with you guys?
In 1996, 97, I mean, he was on the radar screen for a number of years, but we didn't know what his current activity was all about, and so we made a really concerted effort to do that. He became part of the Bin Laden investigation, and he was about ready to flee the country after we had done our initial talk with him, and so we had him arrested, and he's still in custody. I don't know where he is, but he's never been, to my knowledge, he's never been sentenced. We debriefed Ali for a period of years, and you know, he, again, like Jamal, gave us a lot of insight into how Bin Laden trained people, what the training syllabus was like. Ali was responsible for creating something called the Encyclopedia of Jihad, sometimes referred to as the Manchester Manual, and that was a book that was used sort of as a textbook for the Mujahideen to undergo training. And a lot of that information was taken from the U.S. government in training manuals that Ali had access to when he was in the U.S. Army.
Oh, God.
So he would just take the stuff, including maps. And again, this was when show you how far back it goes. This was in the Soviet-Afghan War and so on. And he would go to the map shack at John F. Kennedy Special Warfare School and take these documents and translate them, and then go to the local Kinko store and send them over to the brothers.
Wow. So these,
then,
you know. People wonder how Al-Qaeda could be so effective. They literally had a former Egyptian...
In the person of Ali, not to interrupt Steve, but,
sure.
it leads to a lot of, hand-wringing and eyes rolling. And, to some extent, he was operating in the open. Because during this time that he was John F. Kennedy Warfare School, who was transiting through that school? It is a school where we bring in line officers, senior officers from militaries all around the world, including the Middle East. They knew Ali, some of them, from his days as a colonel in the special forces in Egypt. In fact, I remember one person saying, "Why is he here? Do you know who he is?" And then I remember that he was sent... there's an annual military training exercise with the Egyptian Army. I think it's called Operation Bright Star, something like that. Well, wouldn't you know that Ali, while he's in the U.S. Army, representing the U.S. Army, gets sent to participate in Operation Bright Star, or something like that. I may have the name wrong at the moment, but anyway, you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
That operation... That joint military exercise came to a screeching halt because the Egyptians refused to participate if Ali was there. But anyway, the one thing that Ali was able to, obviously proved consequential is that in 1993, when the United States participated remember the Marines landing on the beach in Mogadishu, Somalia?
Right.
In Operation... to help with the famine relief, and they were anticipating some problems, going in. Well, Ali said that was a very pivotal moment in Bin Laden's thinking process and Zawahiri's thinking, because at that point they saw the United States invading the Horn of Africa, and that it was only a matter of time before the United States would invade Sudan. And so the United States needed to be punished. And Ali was directed to do the surveillance on the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and a number of other targets in Kenya. And he was directed. And his work ethic was extremely good. He really enjoyed It sounds perverse to say that, but he really enjoyed, you know, doing a good job. And he did the surveillance on the U.S. Embassy over a six-day period at all times of the day. And he did a very comprehensive report on it, including diagrams that were made on a first-generation Apple laptop computer using, you know, I guess you would say architectural software or something like that. And he personally presented the plan to bin Laden and Zawahiri and others at bin Laden's headquarters in his home in the Riyadh section of Khartoum. And they made the decision in 1993 to bomb the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. I don't recall whether Ali actually did the surveillance on the embassy in Dar es Salaam. He might have, but I'm a little unclear on that. But I always remember the diagrams that he created because we found them. And to your earlier question, you know, did you develop a respect for who these people were and what their capabilities were? Well, for me, I think listening to Ali describe how he went about his work and looking at the diagrams and having him discuss how he would actually do a surveillance on a target really got your attention. And
well,
of course,
he was a former colonel in the
Egyptian
military.
This is what he did.
Yeah.
So he was very good. And, you know, we eventually found out, you know, the full length and breadth of his surveillance, and then we found some of the other people that were involved, obviously, where the pictures were developed, how he developed, how he moved the pictures around so they wouldn't be discovered. You know, kind of, this is way back in 1993. I mean, you can just see how far back this goes.
And you would share this information, right, your group, with other government agencies?
I mean, sure. I mean, I think that one of the things that certainly the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York and the FBI, you know, we did not want to be accused of not sharing information. I mean, obviously there are sensitivities involved, and obviously you have to go through the right dissemination channels. But I can assure you that whatever information we got that had to do with anything that was targeting, even if the surveillance had been done, you know, years prior, and if we had found out anything that had anything related to a threat or a target having been surveilled, I can assure you that that was sent in what we would call a disseminable form to our headquarters, to the FBI headquarters in Washington, and to the broader intelligence community.
And Jack, you can see the effect of that, right? I mean, it's pretty clear that the Clinton administration took Al-Qaeda pretty seriously. There were several missions against Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, there was a lot of activity.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, I think there's been a lot of perhaps finger-pointing, negative finger-pointing at the Clinton administration about their lack of, I suppose, response or interest. I don't necessarily share that view. I think they understood it was pretty serious. We've obviously come light years forward since then, but they took it pretty seriously. Obviously, the president would not have signed off on that presidential finding if he didn't think that it was serious. I mean, he's the one who acknowledged it, and he's the one who set up this objective to eliminate. And I use that term guardedly, but I'm not saying that he said, you know, go out and kill bin Laden. No, he's, you know, eliminate bin Laden and Al-Qaeda as a threat to U.S. national security. That's sort of the operating theory when it started in 1996.
Okay. I want to move this in a slightly different direction, but it's related to what we were just talking about. From what I've read, all this information that you got from Jamal al-Fadl and from Ali Abdul Saud Mohammed, you got them without ever using enhanced interrogation techniques like waterboarding or any of those things that came to be used later on any of these folks. Now, every qualified interrogator I've ever spoken with, and there have been a few, says that torture is not effective in getting you good information and that any real professional interrogator knows that. Would you agree with that statement?
Yes, I would. You know, I am familiar with some of the work that has been done over the years about how best to get information from people, certainly subjects that have been detained. And so, no, we did not use anything extraordinary, because we knew that we would have to go into a court of law and have everything that we did, everything that we said, everything that we had written be open and transparent, potentially challenged, and ultimately, if we were successful, presented to a jury. So you always were operating under that mandate. It was sort of just like doing a regular criminal investigation that we were all accustomed to. Admittedly, this had high stakes, but it worked extremely well. There were obviously some issues that we had to address along the way. I think we had to convince some of our other government agencies that participated that, you know, who don't like to have things aired in a courtroom, that we could protect interests, we could protect sources and methods. So I would like nothing better than to have Jamal or Ali Abdul Saud or others who, if you will, were handled by the New York office of the FBI, tell their story. Because if you wanted to see contrast to some of the issues that reared their head during the Abu Ghraibs of the world and some of the other stuff that we've now learned about, people would look at this and say that the FBI, as we're sometimes criticized of not connecting the dots and not being this and not being that, I think that in this particular instance, we acquitted ourselves pretty well, and we got a lot of information, and it was treating people humanely, rapport building, gaining trust, protecting their interest, working with lawyers. These people had lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
They knew.
But you know what? But I want to make sure one thing is really clear, though, Jack, if I could. And that is, sure, part of the reasoning is you have to deal with a jury. It's got to be all above board.
Yeah.
But it's more than that, right? It's the effectiveness, the effectiveness of treating them the right way versus.
Of course.
You know,
yeah. We were able to not only sit and build trust with the suspects, or in this case, the cooperating witnesses, that's better put, they learned a lot about us in the process. We were referred to, intelligence people, FBI agents, and Al-Qaeda described us as blood people, that we would subject these people to torture. And when they found out that that wasn't the case, and that they found out that, you know, we would put them in locations and protect them, that we would do our level best to assist them and their families. I mean, this might come as a surprise to some of your listeners that, some of these people really cared about their families. They were involved in jihad. They did some terrible things. There's no question about it. But they were also fathers. They were also husbands. They also had objectives for their kids. You know, you as an interrogator, as an investigator, have to find that sweet spot. Some might be susceptible to flattery. Some may be susceptible to, wondering, is there, I've done bad things, but can my family be saved? It was a very rewarding experience to find these people look at you and come to trust you and come to you and ask for advice. Once you get them talking about their own culpability, they came to a point, and it was consistent throughout, they felt an obligation. They knew they did wrong. They knew they were going to face the consequence. But they also knew that we would protect them, that they would be treated fairly, and that they had an obligation to go beyond and above any agreement that we had with them. It was a badge of honor for them to tell the truth. They didn't equivocate. And, again, when you sit back and you look at our system and how we worked, as cumbersome as it may be to many people and maybe not the most expedient of systems, and we certainly have heard a lot since those days after 9/11 about whether we should Mirandize this person or whether we should do this and whether we should submit people to enhance interrogation techniques. I can just tell you from personal experience that if you have the time and you have the ability, through elicitation and rapport building and trust, you get actionable intelligence that is accurate. You're not looking for compliance. What you're looking for is the truth. I can't help but think how many dead ends people have run to or run down since 9/11 when they thought they had good information and they've subjected people to harsh interrogation techniques. And what you're getting is a story, but you have no way of knowing whether that is true or not.
So how did we get there?
If you have to subject,
how did we get it?
Well, I mean, look, if you have to subject a prisoner, if you will, to 183 episodes of waterboarding, or I don't know, maybe, I don't know how many Khalid Sheikh went through, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but I've heard something like that. You've pretty much figured that he's figured out, you know, what he can take, and he, by his own admission, whether you trust him or not, you know, people make up stuff because we're so thirsty for knowledge, we'll believe anything that they say. It's something. Now, we got to that point because, in my own view, post 9/11, there was a great deal of criticism directed towards the FBI because we were treating terrorism as a law enforcement issue. That really, where 9/11 occurred, to some extent, because I don't know what we were treating this as a law enforcement issue, that we didn't connect the dots, and that if we were to rely upon the U.S. legal system and old-fashioned, you know, interrogation, well, we would make ourselves increasingly more vulnerable, and that we needed to get information right away. We didn't want to involve the courts. We didn't want to involve lawyers. So how do we do it? You ask me, why do we end up there? Well, there's no question that 9/11 was a horrific event. There's no question that seared in the memories of the president and others in the in the Bush administration. You know, we all saw the pictures of those people jumping out of the buildings, the Trade Center. I mean, it's just horrible. I mean, even today, I have a hard time even thinking about it. But that's how we got there. The system wasn't, in their mind, fast enough. We couldn't react fast enough. We needed to get this information. I mean, I think it's fair to say, Steve, that the United States had a lot of information in its possession prior to 9/11. Whether or not, you know, there's always been criticism of the Bush administration, second President Bush, that, you know, that they weren't taking this matter seriously. I'm not sure that that's fair. I think they took the matter seriously. And you always talk about the presidential daily brief on August 6th, you know, Al-Qaeda's threat to the United States. Well, you know, where do you think that information came from?
Sure.
Came from a lot of the stuff that we had.
But that you were doing the right way. You were getting it the right way, and that's why it was real and effective.
It was real. And I'm not sitting here today saying that enhanced interrogation techniques didn't come up with some good information. I think I would be naive to think that they didn't get some stuff. But I was struck by comments made by Leon Panetta, who was the director of Central Intelligence. Been struck by comments that Senator Dianne Feinstein and others have made, and even Senator McCain, that they have said very candidly that the end result of the harsh interrogation techniques, the body of information that was obtained, the number of terrorist threats that were prevented, or the overall value was minimal, and that none of the information that was obtained through those techniques led to the location of Osama bin Laden.
There
now, I would just point out to you one thing as a little sidebar. After 9/11, I was stuck overseas. I was in Yemen. And I couldn't get back to the States right away because the airspace was closed. But I did get back. And the man that you asked me about, Ali Abdul Saud Muhammad, he was in a special section of a prison. And I had him flown to New York. And I debriefed him because he had trained people on how to hijack planes. When 9/11 occurred, he was completely on lockdown. So he didn't have access to papers. He didn't have access to television, so he didn't really know what was going on. So I asked him how he taught people to hijack the plane within Al-Qaeda. And wouldn't you know that, you know, amongst many things that he said was how you staggered people sitting in the plane, how you used and smuggled box cutters and stuff on board a plane. And they knew, because they had the FAA manuals, they knew what you could bring on a plane and what you couldn't.
Wow. So it was all there.
And we had passed information well beyond 9/11 about how Zawahiri and others were contemplating using light planes and ultralights and others planes loaded up with weapons and using as a weapon of mass destruction. They went even so far as to purchase a hang glider in California, and they brought it to Afghanistan to train with it. They were going to put a mujahid on there with a suicide vest on, and, you know.
Now, Mr. Quinn, I have to say, we talked earlier, you mentioned that you didn't necessarily think that the criticisms of the Bush administration were fair. And, you know, this is something that I've talked about on my show a number of times. I want to make sure that before I go into this, since I want to say that I am not a conspiracy person. I do not believe that 9/11 was an inside job or any of that kind of stuff. My contention is that the Bush administration really was a bit negligent here. Could they have for sure seen what was happening and stopped it? I mean, I'm not going to go quite that far, but, you know, look, we had al-Qaeda incidents going straight back to 1993, right? We had the bombing of the World Trade Center in 93. We had an assassination attempt by al-Qaeda against Bill Clinton in 96 that's not really talked about very much. It was thwarted before it really happened, but there was an attempt to get him in 1996. In 1998, the embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed. In 2000, you had the USS Cole attack. And then, you know, between January 2001 and September 2001, there's these multiple warnings that make it to Condoleezza Rice's desk. I look at this, and I look at the fact that you have these multiple attacks. You know that this group is coming after us. And then President Bush appoints as his national security advisor the person whose sole job it is to secure the safety of the United States against attack, as somebody who is an expert on the former Soviet Union. No Middle Eastern experience or terrorism experience whatsoever. I mean, to me, and their focus was ballistic missile defense. They wanted to get SDI going again and all that other stuff. In the face of this group that's attacking us every year or year and a half or 2 years or so, you know, you can call this Monday morning quarterbacking. I think those are a series of mistakes. And then, you know, she has these warnings that reach her desk. She blows off George Tenet, who comes to visit her and warn her about al-Qaeda going to strike the U.S. She takes some of it to Bush. He's not particularly concerned. I know you're not into the partisan gig so much and such, but to me, I look at that and I say, you know, they missed it.
Well, Steve, I realize that, you know, that's an opinion that you've have come to. I try to stay out of the political fray that way, but I think it's important for you to consider what I'm about to say.
Sure.
Rather than looking at maybe the role of Condoleezza Rice or even the president, I can give you an insight as to why I feel a little bit disappointed in the outcome of the 9/11 Commission report. And I want to focus you in on the embassy bombing in 1998. I'm going to explain something to you. Then I think you can draw your own conclusions and maybe go back and look at what you've just said.
Sure.
Here it goes. After the bombing occurred, a man who was supposed to monitor himself, he was in the truck. His name was Olawale, and the truck was being driven by a guy named Ahmed the German. They were going to be mujahid and blow themselves up. When they approached the embassy, Ahmed the German is driving the van full of explosives. Olawale jumps out, has homemade hand grenades, and he throws the homemade hand grenades at the kiosk where the drop-down bar was to prevent the van from going down into the embassy parking area. Olawale threw the hand grenades because when the explosions went off, they felt people would come to the windows to look, and if they could set the device off, more people would be killed by flying glass and the blast wave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Olawale eventually is found through an FBI agent convincing a person to talk because a person who was running a hotel in the Eastleigh section of Nairobi saw a man on the day of the bombing with the back end of his head and clothes burned off, making a phone call. And he felt it was suspicious. That person ends up going into a hospital. The FBI finds him in Nairobi. And an FBI agent and a New York City detective sit down and get the entire story from Olawale, including a telephone number to an al-Qaeda safe house in Sana'a, Yemen, who was the father-in-law of Khalid al-Midhar, one of the pilots in 9/11.
Wow.
That information was shared. I don't think the ink was dry on those reports. So that, and this has all come out, so the United States government knows, has this telephone number, knows this is a hot number, and as a result of that hot number, they know there's a meeting taking place in Kuala Lumpur. And what does that meeting turn out to be? arguably the first organizing meeting for 9/11. And no one's able to get into the meeting, but there are pictures taken. The groups, after the meeting is over, the group breaks up. I think a couple of the pilots are actually at the meeting. And they go hither and thither. I think that some go back to Thailand. Some go on to Saudi. I don't know if they went back to Saudi Arabia. I forget. But 16 to 18 months before 9/11, the government knows that this meeting took place and that some of these people have multiple entry visas to come to the United States and that they're here. And nobody says anything. Now, given what you've just said, I'm sitting here thinking as a, you know, even if the FBI is the gang who can't shoot straight, if you tell us that these people, A, were in this meeting, that B, it may have been the first organizational meeting for 9/11 or worse, they have multiple entry visas to enter the United States. If you tell us 16 or 18 months before 9/11, do you think we would want to know that?
Absolutely.
Do you think we could have done something about that?
I think before some of the other intelligence came about that was talked about, like the Phoenix memo and
I know the Phoenix memo well. You know, I mean, this is as basic as it gets, isn't it?
Go ahead.
People understand this. These are logical, simple leads and steps that have never been adequately explained. The 9/11 Commission says, I'm paraphrasing here, says, well, you know, they failed to put their names on the visa lookout list. I mean, seriously?
No, it's, you know what, the Clinton administration does definitely deserves some criticism, but I think what you're talking about is really one incident that was missed, as opposed to, you know, the period between January 2001 and September 2001, multiple incidents being missed. You know, and I can absolve a law enforcement agency missing one thing, but missing half a dozen to two dozen, that becomes a little bit harder for me to say, okay, you know, I understand that you missed that, or, you know. But again, you know, I don't want to hammer that point too much.
I know you don't.
No,
really,
I mean, what I'm saying to you is that I believe that that the FBI conducted itself well. It got the information. It passed it on as we were instructed to do. What I'm suggesting to you is that somewhere along the line there was human failure and that they didn't pass this critical information on because, to be frank, Steve, you probably would have been in the middle of the conspiracy. And, of course, the next question is, well, if you were, could you have prevented it? Could you have prevented 9/11 from happening? That's a tall order.
I think the right people in the White House from January to September 2001, I like the chances. I'm not saying for sure, but I like the chances.
Yeah. No, and again, I wasn't privy to all that information. I don't want any of you listeners to say, you know, that I think I knew the solution to 9/11 or preventing it. I don't. I'm just telling you what my own personal view is. I don't know what the National Security Advisor at the time was getting on a daily basis. I mean, certainly Richard Clark has stated repeatedly that, you know, he was running around with his hair on fire, banging and screaming, and that he got kind of short shift.
Yeah.
So I think he had some visibility as to what was going on. But, you know, at the end of the day, what often works best is the simplest of stuff. And if you listen to what I just said, you know, you can take away from that, you know, potential consequences or consequences of not acting.
Sure.
And that, to me, is easy enough for my simple mind to comprehend. I couldn't imagine, you know, what any president gets up in the morning and gets these presidential briefs. I mean, and God knows what else they get. Their head must be spinning. And I don't hold any malice certainly to President Clinton or certainly to President Bush. It's, you know, I've always respected the office. They have to live with the consequences. They've made, you know, unbelievable decisions. But, you know, we, as a result of 9/11, have, you know, reinvented the government from a national security perspective. We've spent God knows how many billions of dollars.
Trillions, probably.
When you think about some of the things I've been talking to you about from 1993 forward, I mean, would you ever have imagined that we have a memo from the Office of Legal Counsel that basically states that, you know, through the use of force or predator or whatever, we can kill an American citizen on the battleground if we believe that they are about ready to, I think, I'm not sure I want to be very clear on that, but, you know, commit an act of terrorism or associate with a terrorist group. I know it's a little bit more than that, but, I mean, just think about that. I mean, back in the day, you know, we were debating whether or not we could even retaliate on the embassy bombings by shooting Tomahawk missiles into Afghanistan. Now we have a policy that says, you know, we're going to preempt. And so we've come a long way. And there are consequences for those decisions. I mean, Bin Laden was convinced beyond a doubt that the United States would never, ever put boots on the ground in Afghanistan. Fire Tomahawk missiles, move a bunch of dirt around, that's fine. But never did he think that they were going to put boots on the ground. And I guess you could say that, you know, that's all history. That's what it's all about. And when that decision was made to go in and go after him, you know, when we had him cornered in Tora Bora, that was a pretty important day. I don't know what decisions were made and how he got away, but, you know, we had him cornered then. And I think for the Bush administration and certainly the Obama administration and even the Clinton administration for that matter, bringing Bin Laden to justice was an oath, a solemn oath that I think any of us that were involved in this case, and certainly those that came after me, and certainly I give all the credit in the world to our military intelligence, that was something that needed to be done. I'm not a violent person by any means, but I just think because 9/11, our 12th anniversary, just happened, when I think of the 300-plus firemen that were killed, the number of police officers that were killed, both in the Port Authority, NYPD, my former boss, John O'Neill, my friend Lenny Hatton, an FBI agent who just ran there, because he was a volunteer fireman. You know, those are the things that still resonate with me. It's what some people will do under extraordinary circumstances and never ask a question. What we did to Bin Laden, it was violent. It needed to be done.
You'll never have me shedding a tear for him. That's for sure.
But anyway, this has been a very thought-provoking interview for me.
Oh, I've enjoyed it so much.
And very sobering in a way, because I don't very seldom get a chance to talk about this, and I hope that your listeners understand that I'm just trying to be very honest with people and not, you know, take one side versus the other. It's very complicated business. But I know I sleep very well at night knowing that how we conducted our business, we meaning the FBI, how the U.S. Attorney's Office shaped the investigation and how we got information from people the right way is something that I'll never have to apologize for.
Well said.
And I can defend any day of the week.
All right, we're going to have to end it there. Jack Cloonan, former special agent in charge of the Bin Laden Squad, a real American hero who worked to keep us all safe and did it the right way, the moral way, and the effective way. Thanks so much for coming on the show, sir.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
That's all I have for today's show. Thank you for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, November 24th. And Monday, November 25th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Be sure to follow me and the show on Twitter at Stephen Laser, on Facebook at Making Sense with Steve Laser, and on my blog at stevelaser.blogspot.com. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.